Let's give thanks.
Okay, it's Thanksgiving.
Hello and welcome to Food Talk Radio for the month of November 2013. After a beautiful autumn, the trees have dropped their leaves, and it's time to start thinking about the long winter ahead. In case you couldn't tell already, on this month's episode, we're taking a look at Thanksgiving. We want to give thanks, true thanks, to the organizations who continually provide meals to those in need. There are many, too many to list, but you know who you are, and we wanted to give you a shout-out at the top of our program. We're going to try and turn the tables and give thanks to those that feed us, especially at this time of year, but also to those who work tirelessly year-round. Today's episode is coming to you in three parts. At the beginning, we're going to take a look at local and national food ag headlines, and then shine the spotlight on some agencies that you might not have even heard about and how they were affected by the recent government shutdown. In the second part of the show, we're going to visit with two organizations out in the fields that actually provide food aid to those in need. And then finally, we're going to come full circle and take a look at Thanksgiving with a local family turkey farm here in the state of Vermont, and we'll finish it off with food historian Abigail Carroll, who's going to give us a perspective on the origins of Thanksgiving and the American meal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, this is Emily.
And Emily.
Welcome to Food and Agriculture News. Here's what's been happening internationally, nationally, and locally here in Vermont. In international news, October 16th was World Food Day. The FAO observes World Food Day every year to spread the message that better food systems are required to defeat hunger and malnutrition around the globe.
The Africa Rice Congress, the continent's largest gathering of rice industry experts, policymakers, and farm representatives, has asked the FAO to stimulate national, regional, and global partnerships to help develop Africa's rice sector.
On October 17th, the FAO Director General, the Peru's First Lady and Special Ambassador for the International Year of Quinoa, and the Bolivian Minister of Rural Development and Lands participated in a symbolic quinoa harvest at the FAO headquarters. The harvest was performed by hand, as has been done for centuries in the Andean region.
FAO Director General recently formalized an institutional framework for the relationship between the FAO and La Via Campesina, which is the largest group of small-scale food producers in the world.
In national news, Washington State will be the next to decide if it will require GMO labeling for foods. Initiative 522 would require food products entirely or partially made with genetic engineering to be labeled as such when offered for sale in the state. The labeling would apply generally to raw agricultural commodities, processed foods, and seeds, but not require the genetically engineered ingredients be identified. Washington voters will decide November whether or not to approve this measure.
An early October snowstorm across Colorado, South Dakota, Wyoming, and other areas has killed hundreds of cattle. It's been reported in South Dakota alone that 7,500 deaths occurred. The USDA reported in late October that it will be providing conservation assistance. This assistance will only help remove the cattle bodies and repair property damage caused by the storm.
On October 11th, the House and Senate agreed to begin formal talks on the long-delayed farm bill. 41 House and Senate lawmakers have been assigned to the conference committee. The group represents diverse partisan, ideological, geographic, and political viewpoints. The biggest issue of contention is funding for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Programs, or food stamps. Congress has until January 1 to pass a new farm bill. Otherwise, parts of the federal agricultural policy will revert back to 1940s-era laws and price levels.
The U.S. House of Representatives proved on the 23rd of October that it can agree on some matters and get legislation passed in a bipartisan way. By an amazing 417-3 vote, the House passed the Water Resources Reform and Development Act. This bill includes provisions that update locks and dams on the nation's transportation waterways critical to agricultural trade.
In legal news, on October 23rd, a federal judge said that the United States Environmental Protection Agency cannot legally force a West Virginian chicken farmer to obtain a water pollution permit for the runoff from her chicken farm. According to the judge, the runoff, which possibly contains dust and feathers from the chicken house, which enters the Chesapeake Bay from the chicken farm, was stormwater and not subject to the Clean Water Act.
According to the USDA's first ever farm-to-school census, in the school year 2011 to 2012, schools participating in farm-to-school activities purchased and served over $350 million in local food, with more than half of the participating schools planning to purchase even more local foods in future school years. 43% of public school districts across the country reported having an existing farm-to-school program in place, with another 13% of school districts surveyed committed to launching a farm-to-school program in the near future.
Here in Vermont, the Fish and Wildlife Department has issued 30 fewer permits for moose hunting this year. This is an indication that the population is stabilizing. This year, the state issued 355 regular season and 50 archery season permits to hunt moose.
There are currently two bills in the Natural Resources and Energy Committee designed to expand Vermont's bottle redemption program to include all recyclable beverage containers except those containing milk. Only carbonated drinks and liquor are redeemable under present law, which was originally passed in 1972 to address littering.
That's all for Food and Ag News. This week, we bring you special updates from the government shutdown. Jack Hornickel and Will Duane report on two aspects of agricultural and food law that were impacted by the federal government's shutdown, inspection and licensing.
Many other lesser-known agencies, still vital to the health of Americans, have been furloughed due to the congressional impasse and federal shutdown. One such agency is APHIS, the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, an agency within the Department of Agriculture. APHIS was created in 1971 and employs 7,000 people, 5,000 of which work as inspectors at ports, borders, and farms. Charged generally with the protection of United States agriculture from contagious diseases and invasive species of plant and pest, APHIS gets its authority from many federal statutes, including the Animal Health Protection Act, the Lacey Act, the Plant Protection Act, and the Honeybee Act. APHIS is also integral to the review, authorization, testing, deregulation, trade, and interstate movement of genetically engineered organisms. Under a coordinated framework announced in 1986, APHIS cooperates with the FDA and EPA in this task. Genetically engineered organisms must be field tested for 3 seasons before qualifying for deregulated commercial sale. APHIS provides inspections of ongoing field tests and scientific support in reviewing applications for deregulation or diagnosing a contamination. As a result of the federal government shutdown, many APHIS activities have been suspended. For example, all research has been halted except for the sustained care of the plants and animals already in use. All applications for field testing and deregulation of genetically engineered organisms are on hold. And all facility inspections and investigations related to the Animal Welfare Act, which concerns animals in laboratory testing, have been suspended. It is unclear whether a contamination of genetically engineered organisms, akin to the outbreak of GE wheat in Oregon last summer, would summon APHIS employees out of furlough. If the recent FDA response to salmonella is any indication, an APHIS response to the uncontrolled spread of genetically engineered organisms would merit temporary emergency funding. Some APHIS activities, however, that are funded by grants will continue, such as surveillance of cattle fever tick and other animal disease diagnostics. For Food Talk Radio, this is Jack Hornickel.
We wanted to take a look at how last month's government shutdown affected local industries here in Vermont, specifically the food and beverage industry. In Vermont, we enjoy the highest density of craft breweries and distilleries per capita. This is due not only to the small size of the state, but also the passion of local entrepreneurs and the buying public who support them. Caledonia Spirits, a distillery located in Hardwick, Vermont, has been feeling the effects of the shutdown ever since the government closed its doors at the beginning of October. The makers of the award-winning Bar Hill Gin say that the shutdown has directly affected their ability to get new products onto the shelves. The distillation of alcohol is a highly regulated business. Every 2 weeks, distillers have to pay federal excise tax to the Tax and Trade Bureau. The TTB is the federal agency that approves permits and registrations for distilleries and breweries, as well as granting approval for new products. In order for a new spirit to be sold by a distillery, it has to pass a process called formulation. During formulation, the producer submits basically a recipe for the new product and a description of all the steps necessary for production. After the formula has been approved, the lengthy process of label certification begins. Label approval can take upwards of 45 days, and with the government shut down last month, that number is getting higher and higher. Caledonia Spirits is awaiting approval for a new barrel-aged gin that it hopes to have on the shelves by the end of the year. Head distiller Ryan Christensen says that Caledonia Spirits has this new barrel-aged gin sitting in bottles in the warehouse just waiting for label approval. The original label application was submitted in mid-September, and Caledonia Spirits anticipated the usual 45-day waiting period. However, 2 weeks into that wait, Congress failed to pass a continuing resolution to fund the government. For a small business such as this, any delay in label approval means a loss in potential revenue. Many agencies, including the TTB, were closed to the public. The TTB website said it would resume label application approval once the government funding has been restored. The website now reflects that change. In the meantime, the government was accepting excise tax throughout the shutdown.
This is Bariah Smith with Executive Director Susan Prairie of the South Royalton Area Senior Center.
Yeah, the Center Vermont Counseling on Aging works with 12 different senior centers. The senior centers are contracted under them.
About how many seniors do these programs reach?
Well, for our area, this last year we served 12,885 meals. 5,575 of those meals were home delivery meals, and 7,310 were congregate meals.
Where does all this food come from?
We get donations. We buy some from the food bank, also local stores, and Reinhardt Foods. We're always looking for sales, going by
yeah.
The best bet.
Yeah. So about how much food do you need a year?
This last year we spent $30,623.04 on the food, but then we also did get a lot of donations. We got donations from some of the farmers, the South Royalton Co-op Market, and Willing Hands Group from Lebanon, New Hampshire.
Wow. So even cross state borders.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, it's great.
Do you think the community meals offer more than just a healthy meal? How important is having the social ingredient in meals?
I think it's a big importance, especially for senior citizens. Some of them don't get out only just to come to the senior meals, so they have a lot of interaction with other seniors,
yeah.
Which is good.
With Thanksgiving approaching, are there any special events or extra food drives in the area?
We're actually, November 14th, we're having our Thanksgiving dinner here for the seniors, and usually there's about 100 to 110 people that we serve that day, and that's not counting home deliveries. We usually have another 50 to 60 go out that day.
Wow.
So
do you offer any opportunities to volunteer?
Yes, we're always looking for volunteers. We're looking for drivers, we're looking for people to help in the kitchen, people to help set tables, do games with the seniors, things like that.
Have you found that people have been pretty willing to volunteer in the area, or could you use a little bit more?
I think we could always use volunteers. I mean, sometimes we have a good group, but other times it's hard to find them.
Well, if you're looking for a place to volunteer, the Royalton Senior Center is located at the Royalton Academy on Route 14 towards Bethel. This is Bariah Smith. And thank you very much, Susan.
Thank you.
Ta-da.
Morning.
Okay, well, good morning. So, I'm Emily Lane, and who am I here with?
Carolyn Fry.
And?
Heather Bagley.
Good morning. So, what have we done here today?
Well, we are volunteers helping Willing Hands. Willing Hands is an organization that recovers surplus food from farms, local farms, and also the co-ops in Hanover and Lebanon and White River Junction. And we distribute the food that we collect to service organizations that serve people in need in the Upper Valley.
Well, Healing Hands is focused on handling only the most healthy food that we can get our hands on, so that 95% of the food that we handle is fruits and vegetables. The rest is milk, eggs, and a little bit of frozen meat, and some locally made bread. So our focus is really to fill that niche for food shelves and community meals and people living in low-income housing. They often have access to boxed-in canned food, but rarely have access to free fruits and vegetables, and that's what we're providing. We're serving about 56 organizations every week and year-round. This time of year, we're reaching further afield to distribute the huge surplus that we're getting, like what we got today, the carrots, apples, tomatoes. We do reach further afield. So, and, you know, we're serving about 65 organizations each year, moving about 3.5 to 4 tons of food a week.
Well, that's a lot of food. So just to explain to the listener, what does it take? I guess I'll describe that. I came this morning to Edgefield Farm, and first I stopped at...
Edgewater.
Sorry. And I knew that I needed to go to the farm. I saw the farm stand. I asked the vet at the corner which way to go. And then I arrived just in time to get in the car full of other people and drive down to the field. And then once I arrived, even more people came, and we picked the carrots in about 2 rows. Golly, were there a lot of carrots. And now we're here back at the farm washing the carrots. And then where do they go from here? And how many people do you think we had today helping total?
I think that we had about 20, maybe over 20 people all together. There were some of our regular volunteers from Willing Hands who have been to other gleanings, and there were also some new Dartmouth students this time who had been at a program about hunger that Heather had presented the story of Willing Hands, and they were eager to come and volunteer with us. So we had a great turnout today. Mm-hmm. And the food now, we're still in the background. You can hear the machine going as it's cleaning the carrots. After they're loaded onto the truck, the bins will go back to the garage where the van spends the night. Spends only the night because it will be on the road in the morning. But we have some storage there, very temporary storage for the crops that we glean, like carrots and apples. So it'll go into the garage only for a day or two, and then gradually go onto the van and be delivered out to the organizations across the Upper Valley.
And you said there's something like 50 organizations?
Over.
Yeah, right now we're serving 56. It usually varies between 56 and 60 every single week year-round. These are our food shelves, senior luncheons, and other community meals. We pull into low-income housing areas, and people come out and select what fruits and vegetables they would like from the truck.
Food banks,
food shelves. We have a partnership with the Vermont Food Bank where we give them our surplus and they give us our surplus, and that we're usually talking in terms of tons. So we will probably give them a fair portion of what we're getting today, at least 1,000 pounds of carrots, if not a full ton of carrots. Yeah, so that's kind of how it operates. We have we rely heavily on our volunteers to help us. We have the full-time equivalent staff of just over 2 people, and that includes myself as a part-time executive director. I have an operations assistant who works 8 hours a week, and we have a full-time driving staff. But other than that, that works up to an equivalent of 2 people.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest is all done by volunteers. So people like Carolyn and everybody else you saw today.
So where does a volunteer look to see what's next to get gleaned?
Well, we have an on-site server that helps to notify people of the next event that will be coming up. And if people are interested in becoming volunteers for Willing Hands, they can go to our website at www.willinghands.com. royaltonseniorcenter.org and sign up to be a volunteer. And so when we receive that request from them, we add them to our contact list for Eventbrite, and each time we have a gleaning. The gleanings are very seasonal, and of course, because what we do is harvest surplus produce from the fields. Sometimes it's already been picked and we go and pick it up at the farms, but generally speaking, we are out there in the gardens, as we were today, digging the carrots or picking up the apples. And so it's a very hands-on activity that requires a lot of hands, willing hands.
And do you have any special plans for Thanksgiving, or have you done anything in particular for Thanksgiving in the past? Because in today's show, we're emphasizing that we want to give thanks to the people who give us food. And I'm sure that you guys already have special plans or have in the past done something special to give the food on the Thanksgiving.
In past years, and we hope again this year, we'll be able to supply the Sacred Heart Thanksgiving meal program. Based out of Lebanon, we usually give them pretty much, I don't know if we give them all of the potatoes and winter squash that they need, but a good percentage of it. They're planning on serving 1,000 meals this Thanksgiving Day. So I've already spoken to the organizers, so we will be starting to stockpile for them and doing our best to make sure that we can get them the food that they're needing this year. And after that, we hope to, and in past years, we've been able to help out with the Holiday Baskets, which is the Hartford and Norwich Holiday Basket group. We might not have that exactly
correct.
That's right. But that's what we do, in addition to all the other organizations that will also use the food for Thanksgiving, pass it out for Thanksgiving meals.
All right. Well, on behalf of Food Talk Radio, thank you so much for what you're doing here, and thanks for letting me come out and give a hand.
Well, thank you for being a volunteer today.
Yeah, thank you. Look at you. You're all muddy and well worked, so we certainly appreciate it.
Thanks.
I'm Judy Adams. My husband Dave and I and our family own and operate Adams Turkey Farm. We have been raising and processing turkeys since 1984. Right from the start, we worked with the state of Vermont Meat Inspection Service to build this operation. So we've had a long relationship with the government as far as from that aspect. And that certainly has helped our product because there are rules and regulations which put us in line nationally, but yet we're small enough that we can still operate as a family farm. We always chose to stay within the confines of Vermont. So we decide to stay what is called state inspected versus federally inspected. What that means is that we are allowed by law to sell within Vermont. We can sell anywhere in Vermont that we'd like to. However, our product is not licensed to sell outside Vermont. And that's worked for us because we sell everything we grow right within a few counties. We have a lot of local demand, and it's nice to see that because in the early years, we would raise turkeys for one holiday, Thanksgiving, and all our turkeys would be sold at that time. Our goal of having people eating Vermont turkey year-round was almost like a dream, and today, as we look at our business, we are selling turkey year-round. When we started, my husband Dave and three or four other growers worked tirelessly to promote Vermont turkey over the national turkeys. So we were some of the original members of the Vermont Turkey Association, and we would again brainstorm on how to promote Vermont turkey over like the Butterball, the turkeys that would be shipped in to the grocery stores and every store. And so our first promotion, and actually even with the Vermont Promotion Board, was to promote the freshness of the Vermont turkey, the localness of Vermont turkey, and the original buy local was first brainstormed by the small group of people in the Vermont Turkey Association to sell our Vermont turkeys. And then as the organic movement came into place, we considered becoming an organic farm, but the paperwork was really outrageous. And we were not really comfortable with whether or not that would give our turkeys the best possible nutrition. So we had some issues with that. And along with that, there was a movement for the free-range poultry. And there were so many factors that made that not a feasible venture for us that, again, we said, no, we are not free-range. However, we always knew that our product was superior just in a couple ways of how the birds were raised and in the handling of the birds. What I mean is that we do not have a million turkeys on the farm. They're smaller flocks, under 2,000 birds, so we can pay attention to detail. We can give them the extra care and go the extra mile. So with this locavore movement, which I give credit to the Vermont Turkey Association and the Ag Development Department and some of the local health food stores, it's clicked somehow. Local is better, and it's exactly what we do. And even when people would come up to the farm at Thanksgiving, we would hear, we like to know where our food is coming from. So I think this local movement has tapped into an older feeling of a community where at one point that's all it was local. And for us, like I call it riding the wave, but as I really stop and think about it, it is not a wave. It is a new era that I think is here to stay.
Of the revolution in the early 1800s, the federal era, the birth really of the country, and so we return to that during the wars. And so dinner becomes something different. And the model for the new dinner is Thanksgiving, as I argue. And I say that because Thanksgiving is an American meal. It's, you know, traditionally, you know, your local food, right? Your farm food, your roast bird and your local harvest, you know, root vegetables and whatnot. It's not French in the sense that it's not marked by fancy dishes with sauces. It's not served in sequences, right? There's no super, like there's no oysters, you know? I mean, if you went out, certainly, and certainly among certain, you know, elite families might have had more fancier. And there was a celebration beginning in around, well, it's hard to really pinpoint it, but late 19th century, people were starting to defend Thanksgiving from the encroachment of French ways. And they were saying, you know, it's not American to, you know, eat French peas on Thanksgiving, you know, or various kinds of French foods or, you know, fancy desserts. And part of that was because of the immigration at the time. There was so much immigration that Americans were really being shaken and sort of forced to ask the question of, well, who are we as Americans and what does it mean to be American? And if Europeans come with all of their ways, their food ways, their clothing ways, their religious ways, what are our ways? What makes us distinctive? What is the sort of the Anglo way? And Thanksgiving becomes an expression of that. In the 1920s, that's when the Pilgrims were quote-unquote discovered. Right? People didn't talk about Thanksgiving and Pilgrims like in the same sentence before then. And it actually literally was discovered in the sense that there was a text in which the Mayflower passengers were referred to as pilgrims. They didn't call themselves pilgrims, but there was a text that surfaces in which somebody early on did call them pilgrims. And so that was the sort of birth of the story of the pilgrims and the Indians. But that story then informs the Thanksgiving dinner. And Thanksgiving dinner, think about the dinner itself, right? It is a special dinner, but it's really just ordinary food, right? It's pretty ordinary food. There's a lot of it. There's an abundance of it. That makes it special. It's coming together with family, and it has that Victorian notion of this is a celebration of family, and that makes it, you know, special, but it's not fancy. It's not gourmet by any means. I mean, you can make it that. but traditionally it's not. And so that not only, you know, Thanksgiving not only becomes really important during this time, you've all seen Norman Rockwell's famous image of the family having their Thanksgiving dinner. That was published on the Saturday Evening Post cover, 1943, during World War II. Right, that was a wartime ideal, celebrating the freedom. It was called Freedom from Want. Celebrating the freedom of the country, but also the prosperity, right? There's no want. And so, in a sense, we're reminded that that's in part what, you know, the people overseas, what are the boys overseas, and of course the women too, were fighting for.